Hi, folks. So, this has been a delight collaborating on this with Lauren. We were just, for those of you who just arrived, we were just appreciating the different voices and how this unfolds. So, I'm going to share a little bit about the other two Brahmaviharas, sympathetic joy and equanimity, which in some ways are quite different in terms of how to work with them and how they work. And they're both very powerful tools for awakening and for navigating difficult times. And both of them kind of get under the skin of our normal self-focus and self-interest in these kind of paradoxical ways and open us up, like sometimes kind of like pry us open, which is really excellent. So I'm going to describe what each one is briefly, and then go into a little more depth about both of them. So sympathetic joy, mudita in Pali, is cultivating our own inner joy, our own upliftment from the good fortune and happiness of others, from recognizing the good fortune and happiness of others. This sounds kind of easy and obvious, but actually it challenges our most basic sort of reaction sense of self-clinging. And it's often considered the most challenging or difficult of the Brahmaviharas to master or to really get a sense of. And the second, equanimity, upekkha in Pali, has to do with a balance and calm response to inner and outer arising, to what's happening in life. And as we'll see, it's closely associated with wisdom, with the deepest understanding of the nature of reality. So it's not just like making ourselves be stable. It goes far deeper. So both of these kind of pry open our attached self, sense of selfing or self-identification in powerful and sometimes ways that we might resist. But sometimes when we're resisting, if we are aware of that process, that's when growth happens. So I'm going to start with mudita, sympathetic joy, by telling a little story. And as a few of you know, I was a journalist for 35 years, worked in newsrooms around the region. And so newsrooms are a very, very intense, very collaborative, but also very competitive culture. They're kind of both at once. And there's a strong sense of ethics and quality. And a big part of the annual cycle was the annual award ceremonies with a Society of Professional Journalists. So, oops. And I covered aerospace and advanced manufacturing and international trade. And there was one year where I won an unprecedented, for me, three first prizes. It was like a big deal. I knew that was like the high point of my career in terms of this particular recognition. But back at Puget Sound Business Journal, it just so happened that we were right in the middle of a change of both publisher and editor. They were both rolling over right that week, basically. And plus, I was out on a story the morning of the next meeting. So basically, nothing happened. There was like not a word of appreciation from the publisher because he just missed it and the editor missed it. And I wasn't even there that morning anyway. So it was like, for me, it was like a high point in my career and I heard nothing. And I was like, oh, well, darn, okay, fine. You know, I felt a little whatever. The very next year, our very wonderful real estate reporter, to his credit, got a similar number of first prizes. And this time, the newsroom culture was totally back in place. So he got accolades of praise from the publisher, and he got a big thing from the editor, and there was a party with a cake, and everyone was praising him and saying how great he was. And man, it was, I learned a lot because I was struggling to cultivate sympathetic joy for him. And part of me was all like, well, what about me? You know, I didn't say that, but you know, my little boy self was saying that. And so to really cultivate sympathetic joy for me, I could see how it just peeled off this whole self-attachment. It was like a great learning experience. And so that's why I say it's like sometimes when it's uncomfortable is when we grow the most, right? And I remember that distinctly, and it just ripped me out of my self-interest. And as far as he knew, I was totally happy for him, and that's all he knew, which is what all I wanted him to know. So this shows us, you know, how much we stick with our sense of self and what our sets our self gets, and how this kind of defines and defines our happiness, which is ironic because this sense of self is actually an artificial construct. So the starting point of mudita, sympathetic joy, has to do with cultivating joy. And this is important. The whole idea of cultivating joy is really worth taking in to your heart a little bit as a direction, because one of the wonderful things, extraordinary things about the Buddhist path is how gritty it is. You know, it starts off with suffering. It starts off with difficulty. And when we're teaching, we're often emphasizing what's tough and how we are mindful with it in the middle of it being difficult. But having said that, joy is actually, it's actually a central part of the path and what happens when we're free from suffering. So joy is a wonderful, wonderful thing. And often we see in the suttas, there's something about gladdening the mind. And it reflects how we can cultivate joy and cultivate a positive viewpoint, even when we don't feel it. So the people that talk about positive thinking are on to something. I'm getting back to mudita, but I'm kind of doing a little sidestep here. So as an aside, you know, when the Buddha talked about the pervasiveness of unsatisfactoriness or dukkha or suffering, he was not saying life is gloomy. What he was saying is that life with a constricted attachment to physical pleasures, with an identification with our tight sense of self, they can't be depended on. That's unsatisfactory. But the more we can lighten those things up, life is joyful. Life can be joyful. And you offer this freedom of joy right around non-attachment and non-identification, which is what these two factors, mudita and upekkha, point toward. And in fact, there's a wonderful thing in the suttas. There was a king, as you probably know or may know, the Buddha had a lot of conversations with kings, partly because he came from royalty and partly because he was so amazing that all the local kings in the whole region, several kings that he crisscrossed going hundreds of miles back and forth across North India while he was wandering, they'd be attracted to him and he had these conversations. So I always love this one. King Pasanadi, who was the king in the kind of western area where he often was, visited one time and he was struck. You know, as a king, he was up against all kinds of difficulties, kind of like we are, right? You know, it's like secular life and there's politics. All right, we just had politics. King's up against politics and all kinds of suffering and difficulty. And he was struck by how happy the monastics were. He says, here I see bhikkhus living, which means monastics. Here I see monastics living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. Here I see monastics smiling and cheerful, sincerely joyful, plainly delighting, their faculties fresh, living at ease, unruffled, subsisting on what others give, abiding with mind as aloof as a wild deer's. Doesn't that sound lovely to have that kind of happiness? And remember, this is without all the things that, you know, like we're missing because of the virus. No trips to Europe, no going camping with a bunch of friends. These guys were just happy. So I say all this just to get the idea of happiness into our hearts a little bit here. And of course, this came up in terms of what Lauren was talking about. So in terms of mudita, it's easy, perhaps, or self-evident, to rejoice in the happiness of ourselves. Like, anyone's happy about when good things happen to themselves. That's easy, right? Or even to rejoice in the happiness of our families, those who are close to us. Pretty much everyone does that. No matter, you know, the nastiest dictator likes when their children succeed, usually, unless they're really, really twisted. So that one is pretty easy. But it gets harder when we're considering those about whom we're indifferent or who are even, you know, that which we would consider an enemy. And that's where there is heavy lifting in this practice of mudita. And this was, as a, you know, the case with my journalist friend. He wasn't an enemy at all. But boy, was that hard to rejoice in his good fortune. So a few things get in the way. One thing that gets in the way is our sense of scarcity and jealousy around happiness. We sort of have an innate sense that there's only so much happiness to go around. And if someone else gets more, we'll get less. We kind of think that, right? I mean, where do we get that idea? But we do think that. And if someone else is having a lot of happiness, we kind of, it's like, well, what about me? Kind of like as if there was a finite amount. And when we, so what happens is when someone else is experiencing happiness, we have this kind of contracting sense sometimes if we wish we were having that too. And it takes a little bit of a stretch to get out of ourselves and rejoice in their happiness. But how powerful it is when we can do that. It stretches us right out of our self-clinging, and we can be happy just resonating with their joy. Sympathetic joy is a practice, writes Sharon Salzberg. It takes time and effort to free ourselves of the scarcity story that most of us have learned along the way, the idea that happiness is a competition and someone else is grabbing all the joy. And another related barrier is fault-finding, where we look at someone experiencing joy, which we're not, and try to explain to ourselves what's wrong with that person, that they don't deserve the happiness they're experiencing. We kind of try to undermine them, pick out something wrong with them. And that's it's a bottomless pit. Because for one thing, we don't know what's going on inside of the other, what choices they made to be joyful. And it just doesn't lead anywhere. And the third barrier is indifference, you know, where someone's experiencing joy and we just kind of go flatline. Because if we're not going to get that, we'll just kind of not participate. Kind of a way to protect ourselves, you know, kind of numb ourselves out a little bit because we're basically feeling jealous, but we just kind of go flat. And that doesn't help either. So in all these cases, there's an opportunity to experience joy just by really resonating with someone else's joy and appreciating their joy and being happy for them and letting go of our own self-clinging, our own, you know, idea that the things that make us happy, we can hold to ourselves, because it just doesn't work that way. Lauren talked about the Metta Sutta, where it talks about what the Buddha said about loving kindness, and he said the same thing about sympathetic joy. He says, one abides pervading, I love this because it's so expansive, and it gives us a sense of how we can cultivate this. One abides pervading, and he's talking about quarters of the universe, like directions, I should frame that. One abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with sympathetic joy, likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to oneself, one abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with sympathetic joy, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. So that's really beautiful. And I think the key phrase is to all as to oneself. To have that attitude of just rejoicing in someone else's happiness, to all as to oneself. And then paradoxically, if we let ourselves just let go and rejoice, we get happy. I was happy at that party, you know, when my friend got his award. I really was. Once I just got past my little whiny self, I was like, oh, this is great. I still remember it. I feel really, when I think of it now, I feel happy for him. It was such a great accomplishment. So happiness without conditions is kind of what the Buddha taught. Like in terms of those monks, they didn't have any outward conditions that made them happy. They just were happy internally because of their practice. That's what struck the king so much, because he was like this wealthy guy. He was like, you know, he was like the tech executive from Medina of his day. And he had it all. He had a Lamborghini. Well, he had a chariot, but it was parked outside, but he had it all. These monks didn't have nothing, and they were totally radiantly happy, happier than he was. So he kind of got that, right? So wherever someone's happy, we can just like appreciate them and kind of ride on it. It's interesting. It's kind of like a, it's like a lever, almost like pole vaulting. They can like lift us into happiness just because when others are happy. Just got to let go of our clinging a little bit. So equanimity, upekkha, is a whole different level, and in a way it encompasses what is sometimes in Dharma called conventional and ultimate levels of reality. So in a conventional level, equanimity suggests kind of emotional steadiness or calmness of the heart and mind, no matter outward conditions. Someone that's like just really stable and just keeps, you know, you can depend on. And that's something in a conventional level as people, you know, as people that develops in people. A lot of good people are like that. You know, I know some ministers are just great, pretty unflappable, just really kind, just straight up healthy human beings. They don't have a lot of garbage in their hearts, so there's not a lot of hot buttons that get kicked off. You know, and you can depend. There's a kind of equanimity there just on a conventional human level, just from being a healthy person. So, you know, we can do our work to become healthy persons, and that will, on that level, will help. Emotional maturity, you might call it. It's a real gift. It's a gift to others. If we're parents, it's a real gift to our kids, right? To be stable and not flip out or react or something. But there's a deeper and more profound layer of equanimity, kind of the ultimate level that gets down into the heart of what awakening is. And that's why in the Brahma Viharas, it's often considered the kind of the culmination one, the final point. The word upekkha in Pali, it means to look over, kind of a sense of like gazing over. And refers to equanimity that arises from the power of mindfulness, which is the ability to see without being caught by what we see. And in a sense, that is the power of mindfulness. We're aware, we're mindful, we don't get caught by it. But equanimity really helps us understand how this works and how powerful it is in our lives, externally and internally. And what I mean by that is in terms of our own internal stuff and then circumstances that surround us in both cases. And equanimity, in my experience and from what, you know, I've been taught and everything, gradually emerges through our mindfulness practice. It's not so much something you cultivate with phrases. You can cultivate it, but it's not, the phrases practice is more in terms of metta and karuna, loving kindness. And equanimity is more like it emerges. There are phrases, but I think this works better. It emerges through our mindfulness practice as we see through clinging, which we gradually do. We cultivate mindfulness in each moment of arising, you know, stuff arises and passes, pleasant or unpleasant. And we gradually dismantle that sense that there is anything worth grasping. And we gradually dismantle the sense there's anybody to do any grasping, kind of takes it apart from both ends. Gil Fronsdal is a great Western teacher. He says, one of the primary insights is the nature of impermanence. In the deepest forms of insight, we see that things change so quickly that we can't hold on to anything. And eventually the mind lets go of clinging. Letting go brings equanimity. The greater the letting go, the deeper the equanimity. So this letting go kind of creeps up on us like cat feet. We hardly even know it's happening. It's one of the subtle things about practice, you know. Just when you think nothing's happening, it is. And I have this, it's not exactly like blind faith, but it's like, yeah, confidence. And the ironic thing is these steps often happen, like I said, just when we think nothing's happening or when we think we're stuck, but we keep trying to be mindful. just when we're stuck is often when we're pushing through something, and then this letting go happens. So there's nothing wrong, you know, with enjoying ice cream or whatever, as long as we're not lost in it. If we're mindful eating the ice cream, that's fine. There's equanimity there. But when we're lost and in a pleasant experience, we'll be less tuned into what's around us. And we'll pivot towards that sensation. And it puts grasping and contraction. And that's not equanimity. It's not stable. It's not stable. So the whole secret, just take things as they are. And this practice, a moment-by-moment awareness, we just learn to relax in full acceptance of whatever's happening in the moment. And it's like it's a balance. It's like a keel in the water. It keeps us upright. You know, it doesn't mean we don't take action when there's time to take action, but we just are aware of what's floating by, and we can take action from a balanced way. So the practice is not about equanimity. It's not about distancing ourselves from life, for instance, from pleasant or unpleasant. Quite the opposite. It's about looking toward becoming conscious. Upandita, Burmese teacher, says equanimity is not insensitivity, indifference, or apathy. It is simply non-preferential. Under its influence, one does not push aside the things one dislikes or grasp at the things one prefers. The mind rests in an attitude of balance and acceptance of things as they are. So we're not talking about indifference or aloofness or complacency, all of which are kind of pulling back. But rather, equanimity is part of a full embrace of awareness. And it's not, I had it written down, I forgot it. Not the evil twin. What is it? The near enemy is indifference, you know? And it looks like equanimity, but it's not. So sometimes these near enemies can be really helpful, because you can kind of go, oh, wait a minute. Am I being indifferent? Okay, that looks like it, but it's not. Equanimity is dynamic and spacious and empty and clear and present. I'll finish with a quote from the Buddha, from the Dhammapada. He says, as a solid mass of rock is not stirred by the wind, so a sage is not moved by praise and blame. As a deep lake is clear and undisturbed, so a sage becomes clear upon hearing the Dharma. Virtuous people always let go. They don't prattle about pleasures and desires touched by happiness and then by suffering. The sage shows no sign of being elated or depressed. So that's the deep keel of equanimity. Thank you.